This podcast of Word of Mouth is sponsored by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com.
And
Northeast Credit Union, helping their members save money
through free checking accounts and refinancing of auto,
home, and personal loans.
Northeast Credit Union, encouraging you to discover the difference at necu.org.
Federally insured by NCUA.
Equal housing opportunity.
And Dartmouth-Hitchcock.
Creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h.org.
Word of Mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Cast your mind back to the chat rooms and message boards of the ancient internet, places to connect communities of interest, from stamp collectors to much seedier types, to like-minded people from the world over. Then came the downsides, fears of kids getting lured in by strangers, and that millions flocking online to chat would kill face-to-face communication. As MySpace, Facebook, and Twitter declared the self to the world, those chat rooms receded until recently. Slack, GroupMe, WhatsApp, and a number of other apps are bringing chat back. Tech and culture writer Kyle Chayka wrote an article for Gizmodo defending chat, in fact, identifying chat circles as the only truly intimate online experience left. Kyle, great to have you back on Word of Mouth.
Thanks so much for having me.
So while use of texting and social media did skyrocket, online chats receded. Why did they fall out of fashion?
I think as the internet grew, we actually got opportunities to connect with a much larger group of people. So as we found Facebook and big social media platforms, we were so excited to reach, you know, hundreds and thousands of people instead of just a few close friends. But I think lately we've been understanding that that's also a risky experience to be that exposed in the world.
So it sounds like you've had some experience with chat. What is it now for you?
So I think chat right now for me is really a way to connect to the people I'm closest with. And it's become kind of a small online space for just a few close friends. And specifically, I have a GroupMe chat with just a few friends that we all use it on our phones and our computers. And this is just a little chat room, and it looks kind of like a text window almost. Mm-hmm. But we all can interact with each other. We can post emoji. We can like share photos. And it's just a lot of fun. It's a really nice way to share space with people online without having to be so exposed.
Yeah, I guess no one's watching, right?
Yeah, so it feels much more intimate. And I mean, personally, I feel much more able to, you know, share secrets or share feelings in that as opposed to Twitter, where it's obviously a much more public forum.
Well, I would welcome a place that's less snarky and, let's say, tacitly, sometimes overtly competitive, you know, than social media can be. But do you get to real conversations without being face to face?
I think you can. Chat online is obviously helped by having face to face experiences. But I think, and psychologists have found this as well, that within text-only chat spaces, you're actually more able to share things about yourself. And maybe that not having the burden of face-to-face interaction can help you be more intimate.
But you can also get it wrong, right? You know, that idea that you say something to someone and without a facial expression to follow it up, people can misinterpret.
They can definitely misinterpret, and text, I think, always has that danger. But I think if you grew up on the internet as I have and have enough experience and know the people you're talking to, it's pretty easy not to mess things up too badly. I think if you're trying to chat with strangers, you're not going to have as intimate or as close of an experience. But maybe that's what bigger social media platforms are for, is connecting with people you don't know. And then maybe someday you'll chat with them privately.
Well, you also mentioned GroupMe, also Slack you tried for the article, and WhatsApp. Something that I've used with people who live overseas, I guess it's texting without getting the text messaging charges. Any other advantage to WhatsApp?
Well, WhatsApp also has a variety of multimedia options that are a lot of fun. So you can share audio and you can, post various emoji. And it's kind of a richer experience than just text SMS messages.
Do you have to convince your friends to download these in order to use them, to sort of expand your chat circle?
Yeah, I think you do. I mean, my GroupMe is very private, but there's a larger Slack that I'm in. And it's just sometimes you have to tell people what the advantages of those are or kind of show them what's going on before they actually want to be a part of it. Because everyone knows what text message is, but maybe group chat is a foreign experience now, even though it wasn't 10 years ago.
Mm. There's still the danger, of course, of whiling away many, many hours in these group chat rooms. And though you say it is safe and private and I guess wouldn't nix the job interview or offer, because there's no photos of you doing jello shots in your underwear or whatever.
Yeah.
Someone in one of your circles could, for whatever reason, get mad, want to prove a point, post those conversations, couldn't they?
Yeah, definitely. And actually, that process of sharing something that was supposed to be private has been recently called doxing. So if a friend tries to dox you, then they're sharing some kind of secret that you posted online with the wider world. So that risk is always there. And I think in group chat, you still have to trust the people you're sharing with mm-hmm. enough.
Never mind what the people behind Slack or WhatsApp or GroupMe might do with your archive chats. Any ideas?
Yeah, so I think you have to assume that these companies still have access to everything you're saying. So there's always the possibility that the government or some other entity could track through what you've said and kind of expose that. So I don't think you want to always be aware of that, as you should be on any online platform.
Mm-hmm. Well, Facebook just launched Rooms earlier this fall. There are other big social media companies trying to get some kind of, chat room experience like Snapchat. Do you think that people are seeking and finding refuge online, or is this just, sort of another reaction to public social media that's probably going to snap back the other way?
I think to some extent it is a pendulum, but I think lately, especially with surveillance news and things like Gamergate, which have kind of proven the negative side of public interaction online, that we are going out of our way to seek out small spaces and creating them for ourselves through group chat. And even on Facebook, if you choose to open a room, that's a smaller space, but you're still within this wider platform. So you can kind of have both worlds at once, which I think is a good thing.
How about, Kyle, that worry from way back that we will, if we keep using these kind of media, lose our ability to communicate face to face?
Well, I hope the two coexist. I think personally, I find that I've kind of developed two different fluencies. One is talking through group chat and interacting on social media. And the other is, still maintaining those face-to-face relationships and making sure the two complement each other. So I think we always have to keep going out of our way to seek people out and see them in person. These group chats are not going to ever be a substitute for real life.
That's the tech and culture writer, Kyle Chayka. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can read Kyle's article, The Only Truly Intimate Online Experience Left, from Gizmodo. There's a link at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Up next, from the mythical fountain of youth to modern-day anti-aging products, humans have long been charmed by the prospect of remaining forever young. But what if the key to a long and healthy life is actually located in our minds? Stay with us for the story of a psychologist who set out to reverse the aging process. That's when Word of Mouth returns after a short break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. You're only as old as you feel. Age is just a number. Don't worry, be happy. Sounds like empty fluff slapped on motivational posters. But what if it is more than that? What if the fountain of youth and the secret to healthy living is actually located in our minds? A psychologist set out to test the idea with a group of septuagenarians in New Hampshire. This was back in 1981. She called the experiment counterclockwise, and without the aid of a time machine, she managed to transport 8 70-year-old men 20 years into their past to see if they could reverse the aging process. Joining us to talk much more about the experiment and its implications is Bruce Grierson. He's a social science writer. He wrote the article, What If Age Is Nothing But a Mindset, for the New York Times Magazine. And Bruce, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Well, thanks so much, Virginia, for having me.
So let's start with an explanation of the original counterclockwise experiment. And this was conducted by Harvard psychologist Ellen Langer.
What Ellen did, now she was just beginning her career, very early stages of her career at Harvard. She's now the longest serving psychology prof in the department there, but this was a long time ago and she was just getting going. And it was a pretty radical, ambitious, provocative experiment to try back then. But she's always been interested in what she calls youth primes, things that put us in a position where we think about ourselves as younger, or we're kind of cued or prompted to think feelings of youthfulness are triggered. I guess that's the way to put it. And so she decided that what if we could put a bunch of older people in a setting where all the cues and all the environmental prompts suggested that it was, in fact, much earlier in their life than it really was. So they sort of tricked out an old converted monastery in New Hampshire to look like it was 1959. So everything about the decor and the books lying around and the shows on the black and white TV were from 1959. And the experimental subjects were encouraged to not just sort of think of this as a bit of a lark, but actually to try to buy into the illusion that they were in 1959, that they were 20 years younger than they were. And she coached them that if they were successful at this, they could actually see some really startling changes in their physiology, actually, and they would feel and measure as younger men.
So there were no mirrors there, no photographs allowed that showed them as their contemporary selves.
Right.
What did she find? Did it actually work?
It did work to some degree. They were tested before and after on a whole battery of measures, as I say. Even things that you would never expect could possibly change under those, in a week of circumstances like that. Things like hearing and vision, and there were cognitive tests, and there were, you know, stretching and strength tests. And so they got the exact same battery of tests after the experiment was finished, a week, or I think it was
5 days, I think.
5 days, mm-hmm. 5 days, yeah. They scored better on just about all those measures. And when there's a small sample size, you have to have a large effect for anybody to take it seriously. And this was a small sample. There were only 8 men. And so the effect had to be really pretty significant. And it was.
Yeah, and amazing results, but yet she never published these results. Mm-hmm. Why not?
Yeah, well, she was, as I say, she was early in her career, and I think she got a little bit scared. She just thought that they wouldn't, well, or she thought it wouldn't be published. She just didn't think that it would sort of penetrate the defenses of the judges in any major journal she sent it to, because as she keeps talking about, you know, mind-body stuff was just not very big back then. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is long enough in the past that this was all pretty woo-woo back then, and now we now know that, you know, mind-body effects and the placebo effect are real things and can be measured, and there's a fair bit of data, but back then it was pretty out there.
Well, in 1981, this sounded woo-woo, to use your term. But now, are there more of these kind of experiments being done?
I think that it's pretty well established that mind and body are pretty interconnected now. And we still don't really know the mechanisms. But one kind of hypothesis, I think that the way Ellen might frame it is that you have a kind of mental health on one side and physical health on the other. And then you have the immune system, which works as kind of an intermediary between the two. And there's lots of evidence now that, even when you think of it, things like stress management and managing loneliness and isolation, those are psychological interventions, but we know they have huge impact on our physical health. But in 81, we didn't really know. I mean, people were talking about it, but there hadn't been all that much science to establish it. And now, I mean, even looking at the science of mindfulness meditation or meditation and the effect on how that can lower blood pressure and lower heart rate, and these things are absolutely established now. So that's been a change in the last quarter century for sure.
What if age is nothing but a mindset? Well, Bruce Grierson is with us. He's a social science writer. He wrote an article in the New York Times with that very title, and he looked at a number of different placebo-based experiments on how the mind does actually physiologically control the aging process. The article was a huge hit, with hundreds and hundreds of comments from readers. Langer's current project takes this idea of the mind-body relationship and the healing power of the placebo further, shrinking tumors. Now, how is this experiment to work?
Well, Ellen decided that she really wanted to see how powerful this is, and she imagined the sort of one of the most dramatic possible outcomes you could have. And she had personal reasons for doing this too, which I talk about a little bit in the article. But she's currently undergoing an experiment where she has women with stage 4 breast cancer. They're stable. They're stable enough to travel, but this is a pretty dire diagnosis. And they are going to be brought to a villa in Mexico and given the same sort of counterclockwise intervention that those men in New Hampshire were back 30 years ago, in the sense that they're going to be brought back in time to a time before their diagnosis. And Ellen's hypothesis is that if they have similar kind of cues that will make them think of themselves as younger and sort of transport themselves back to a time before the diagnosis, they might be able to get a little bit better, mm-hmm. or shrink the tumors, I guess is the simplest way to say it. Can the effect of the mind alone have an impact on something as serious and intractable as cancer?
I'm also thinking about placebos in general. I mean, there is a thought that they're manipulative on some level or unfair. You know, somebody gets the good cancer drug, somebody else gets the sugar mm-hmm. pill. Even cruel on some level. What is Langer's approach? How much does she let people know what's going on?
If you know what's going on, if you're told that the pill that you're going to take is in fact a sugar pill, or in this case of the cancer study, these women obviously know that that the intervention here is supposed to help them. And so what that's called is an open placebo, as opposed to the deceptive closed placebo that most of us are familiar with. And an open placebo is if you know the pill that you're taking is a sugar pill, how can it possibly work? Doesn't that defeat the whole idea of placebo? And there's some evidence that even if you know that it's fake, that it still can work. There were some studies done with ADHD kids who were able to wean themselves off their medication, and there was a study done with irritable bowel syndrome, an open placebo study that showed that it can work. So it seems wildly counterintuitive that an open placebo study could work, but that's what effectively this cancer study is. They know that what's supposed to happen. They know that it's merely psychological, and Ellen's hope is that that doesn't matter. It'll still work.
Is there a concern, Bruce, that by claiming that the mind can heal the body, that patients who do succumb to illness or aging will just feel, you know, dejected, weaker if they can't will themselves to get better?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's the whole blaming the victim
right.
thing. And that, if you look at the comments on the following that article, there were a fair number of people who latched onto that very point. And we addressed it in the piece, and I asked Ellen about it too. And she has been actually talked to by people after her presentations and things. One guy in particular, whose wife died of cancer, and she fought it, and she still couldn't overcome it just mentally. and he felt like they'd been presented as failures because they weren't able to defeat this thing. And this guy felt that Ellen was effectively blaming the victim if they can't manage to do it. And Ellen would say that, I mean, it's a tough one. I don't think it's incumbent upon everyone to be able to beat every disease that they face. I think realistically, is this going to work for everybody? Is this going to shrink tumors? I think it's unlikely. But I also think that Ellen has done enough sound work to be taken seriously and given a chance to see whether it can.
Well, Bruce, thank you very much for running through the story with us.
Well, thanks so much for having me.
Bruce Grierson, social science writer and the author of What Makes Olga Run. The subtitle of the book says it all. The mystery of the 90-something track star and what she can teach us about living longer, happier lives. We found his recent article, What If Age Is Nothing But a Mindset, in the New York Times Magazine. You'll find a link to read the article, currently with 625 comments, at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Stick around for more Word of Mouth. When we return, we're going to visit an apothecary museum for a tour of early American medicine. But first, the news. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The Washington, D.C. area is jam-packed with museums, but not all of them have Smithsonian in the title, and not all of them are on the National Mall. The Stabler Ledbetter Apothecary Museum in Old Town Alexandria is just one of those off-the-beaten-path collections. It is a fully preserved 19th-century pharmacy with all the weird drugs and implements you might expect to have been used back then. There are drawers full of Job's tears, bins of unicorn root, and bottles of something called meat juice, which was used for customers with anemia. Lauren Ober spoke with the museum curator Callie Stapp and brings us the story.
For those of us who were born after the 1930s, what is an apothecary?
An apothecary is essentially a doctor and pharmacist all rolled into one. So he would dispense medicines just like a drugstore we think of today.
Describe for us what this looks like in here.
In the 1850s, the son of the original founder decided he would spruce things up a bit. So it looks a little bit gingerbready house inside. And then you also put in some really fun counters that have beveled glass to really show off your fun products like hair tonics and perfumes. But then you also have our label under glass bottles, which contained all of the raw ingredients that you would use in all of your medicines. So they have fun colors. Some are blue, some are yellow, some have actual bits of bark in them and things like that, but they were meant to show off, so they're done in nice foil glass labels.
There are tons of these glass bottles. A lot of these have stuff in them still, which creeps me out a little bit. So are these the real things that the apothecary would use?
They are. This is the same materials. That's one of the great things about our collection, is that we have the original materials in them that they would have used in the 1850s.
You ever opened any of these up and smelled them?
No.
Why not?
I can only imagine how terrible they would smell.
Really? You've never been tempted just to put your face in there and just take a whiff?
We have boxes of mostly root-type material upstairs. One of them is a skunk cabbage root, and it smells pretty terrible. I can only imagine it probably smells slightly less terrible than it smelled 100 years ago, but pretty awful smelling. So,
or more terrible if it's been sitting around for 100 years.
One can only guess how terrible it is.
So with all of these medicines, like, how would they prepare them?
So you would come in and describe what you needed, and the pharmacist or apothecary would, you know, pull out the raw ingredients. And you would use a mortar and pestle a lot of times if you had especially like roots or things that needed to be ground up that weren't already in a liquid form. And so you would just take it and you would just smash it down, just like you do for, you know, cooking and things like that today.
Yeah, so they would get at it in there and grind it up.
That's it. And then you could put it in your whatever you're using with. So if you're making it into a pill form, you can put a little bit of sugar or chocolate around it. You can use a pill roller, which we have several of, and you could roll it out into long pieces and then little smaller bits and send it off with the customer.
Shall we go have a look-see upstairs?
Let's go upstairs, because you will probably find a few things that you will have never seen before. We usually use it as our Harry Potter room, so a lot of kids get very excited because it kind of looks like the apothecary from Harry Potter.
Oh, this is something.
So we have what is essentially walls on each side and down the middle of raw ingredients in tins and also in drawers that have the ingredients pasted, you know, painted on the front.
Do any of these drawers have stuff still in them?
Most of the drawers actually still have things in them. We have wild carrot tops, which are always really fun. Job's tears, which are just basically small berries. A lot of times you would give them to kids to teeth on.
What are some of your favorite like areas or things, not maybe your most favorite, but some of your favorites?
So one of the things that is kind of among one of my favorites is what's called the Valentine's meat juice. This gentleman named Man Valentine had a very sickly wife. And so he invented something that would press raw meat and you would take the juice from that and you would combine it with, you know, a few other things and serve it to people who were probably very anemic and kind of sickly and they got better.
Why couldn't they just eat meat?
That is a good question. I don't have the answer for that, but it took off. We have beef, wine, and iron that was also very popular.
If you're pressing out a slab of meat for the juice, you could just eat the meat, I guess. I don't know.
Maybe they're just thinning it out. It's a little bit cheaper. It's just one of the things that takes off.
Could you imagine in 200 years a preserved CVS as a museum?
Not at all. Not in the least.
And our thanks to producer Lauren Ober for that story. Western history has long been told as a tale of great men. Rarely do we hear about the others who helped them along the way, the coaches and mentors and benefactors and muses who toiled away silently as the celebrated one sucked up the spotlight. A new book unearths history's secret sidekicks, the men and frequently women, and in the case of Emily Dickinson, a little dog named Carlo, who rode shotgun to those celebrated for great inventions and theories and feats and works of art. The productive trio of Jenny Wawolski, Julia Rothman, and Matt LaMoth has given these uncelebrated wingmen their own stories and some delightful illustrations in a new book, The Who, the What, and the When, 65 Artists Illustrate the Secret Sidekicks of History. And the graphic artist Jenny Wawolski is on the line to tell us more about the book. Hello.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
So I want to pick up on Emily Dickinson's dog. This was a Newfoundland pup named Carlo. Because knowing about him kind of punctures some of the myths of Emily Dickinson as a recluse who rarely left her attic. Tell us about this relationship.
So Carlo was a puppy that was given to Emily when she was 19 years old. And Dickinson was a known recluse. And the walks that she took with Carlo's were one of the few times that she left the house. And she was said to write her best poetry during his life. And after he died, she wrote, "I explored little since my mute Confederate died." Mm. And she never really had another dog and left the house less and less after that.
Well, that's a pairing that you might not guess at, Emily Dickinson and her little dog. But there's another one here that struck me, the role that a retired Louisville police sergeant plays with an angry young man named Cassius Clay. What's the story of that twosome?
So Cassius Clay was 12 years old when he met his amateur boxing coach, and the story is that he received a red twin bicycle for his birthday, and he was extremely proud of his bike, and he went to some sort of community center with his friends, and after leaving the center, he realized that his bike was stolen, and he was rightfully extremely angry about the fact and was taken down to the basement of the community center, where Joe Martin took down his information acting in the role of policeman. And Cassius Clay was extremely upset and kind of vowed revenge on whoever stole his bike. And Joe Martin said, "Well, if you're going to make all these threats, you know, you may as well be able to back him up. Do you even know how to fight? And Cassius Clay said no. And so Joe Martin said, well, you know, let me teach you, because he was also an amateur boxing coach. And so he remained as coach until, you know, Muhammad Ali was 18 years old and led him to the Rome Olympics, where he won the gold medal. And after that, he became a pro and switched coaches, but they remain lifelong friends.
Well, there are so many wonderful little snippets about people that we learn here, but many of them do sound at first blush like narratives that we've heard before. You know, the woman behind the man, like Edith Bowling Wilson, but she actually ran the White House after her husband, Woodrow Wilson, had a stroke. Or, the far younger woman who plays muse or model to the established artists. Any stories that came up for you in this book that turned that old chestnut around?
One story that definitely doesn't fit the bill is the story of Bayard Rustin, who was Martin Luther King's sidekick in our book. And Bayard Rustin influenced Martin Luther King to be a pacifist. He had a Quaker upbringing and was motivated to fight discrimination after being refused service at a restaurant. And he met King when they were traveling to Alabama for the Montgomery bus boycott. And at the time, King had armed guards protecting his house because it was bombed before, but Bayard convinced him to give up the guns and take up nonviolence. And because Rustin was an openly gay man and active in communism, in communist movements, nobody wanted him to be the head of the movement. And so he was really kept behind the scenes, even though he was a bit of a mastermind for a lot of the big movements and the March in Washington.
Well, mothers, of course, can be that invisible and sometimes very visible force behind a lot of creative people. I'm thinking of Roald Dahl, Gladys Presley, mother of Elvis Presley, and Andy Warhol's mother, Julia, illustrated here by the New Yorker cartoonist Leslie Herman, piling Campbell's soup into a cart at the supermarket. What was Julia to Andy?
Julia was a Czech immigrant who came to live in suburban Pittsburgh, and she was pretty lonely and didn't have too much of a social life just because she didn't have any friends or relatives nearby. And Andy was a pretty sickly child, and so he would stay home from school a lot, and in some ways she encouraged him to do so. And in order to entertain each other, they would make art together. And because they didn't have too much money for art supplies, she gave them used comic books and grocery store labels to repurpose and to make into new work. And so really that's how he first became an artist. And she would make art alongside him. And he always really admired and loved her work as well. And they collaborated on books together. He loved her handwriting. And so he would have her sign his paintings later on when he became a more renowned artist. And when he moved to New York to try to be an illustrator, he had a really hard time of it in the beginning. So he asked her to join him in New York, and she left Pittsburgh and lived with him. And as he started getting a bit more famous, they had a more contentious relationship because he became kind of embarrassed by her because she didn't speak English very well and would wear these old-fashioned clothes. And he had a really hard time of it. When she passed away, he didn't attend the funeral and couldn't even bring to tell his friends about her death.
Of course, this book, the subtitle is about artists illustrating the secret sidekicks of history. And the illustrations are just fantastic and often whimsical, often with famous portraits, like we see Picasso's portrait of Gertrude Stein behind Alice B. Toklas, or, you know, a portrait of Dostoevsky, or Charles Darwin's photo sitting on an armchair next to J.D. Hooker. How did you work with the artist to come up with these?
We gave the artist an incredible amount of leeway. We really, all we did was we sent them an essay and told them that the only thing they had to do was to feature the unknown person. Some people made more straightforward portraits of the unknown person. Some people set up whole scenes and pulled little tidbits from the essays and the biographies to make them really specific, but, you know, it was really left up to the artist's imagination to do what they wanted.
Well, I love the story of J.D. Hooker, because had he not worked with Charles Darwin, history may have turned out very differently. And, you know, it makes me think when I'm reading this, everybody that we become attached to changes our lives in some way.
But some people, had they not had these sidekicks, things may have turned out completely differently. Like, what did Hooker do for Darwin?
So Hooker and Darwin were communicated almost exclusively by mail. They wrote, I think, over 1,400 letters to each other. And Darwin wrote his first reference to evolution to Hooker in one of those letters. And at the time, it was obviously extremely controversial because it went against the Bible and the Christian belief. So Darwin was a bit afraid to publish the work, and Hooker really encouraged him to do so. You know, everybody thinks of Darwin when they think of evolution, but it was probably only because Hooker pushed him to publish his findings first.
You have to have a certain lack of ego to be a sidekick, right? I mean, only a certain kind of man would put up with being known as Mr. Earhart, as Amelia Earhart's husband was known as. Was there frustration at being the one that was less seen?
Sure. I think that for a lot of these people, they really loved, they didn't want to be in the foreground. They kind of like the role of sidekick. The one that comes to mind is the story of Ian Stewart, who was the sixth Rolling Stone.
Mm-hmm.
And he was one of the founding members of the Rolling Stones, but was kicked out by a new manager because he didn't fit the profile of a rock and roll star and was said to look too much like a coal miner. But instead of being, you know, upset with the situation, he stuck around and followed the band for the remainder of his life. He played on most of the records, but he did really rudimentary things like tune guitars and drive them around to gigs. And he was just still really part of the band without being in the band. And when they were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, they listed him as a member.
Oh, nice, Rolling Stones.
Yeah.
But do you think
do you think
partnerships need something like that? One is the blooming flower. One is the toiling gardener.
Yeah, I think that's, in some ways, I feel like that's how relationships form. A lot of the times, there's kind of a natural progression where one person takes the role of being in the foreground and the other person is more in the background. I think it just happens naturally.
Well, Jenny Volvosky, a delightful book. Thank you very much for speaking with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jenny Volvosky is a graphic designer and author with Julia Rothman and Matt LaMoth of The Who, The What, and The When. 65 artists illustrate the secret sidekicks of history. We have a link to a BuzzFeed article on it with some of the terrific illustrations. You'll find that at wordofmouthradio.org. Stay with us for the story of a man on a mission to foster future genius. And it's all about creating the right kind of toy. That story when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before the break, we heard about some of history's sidekicks, the unsung people who inspired or assisted great artists and scientists and thinkers. Well, not everybody is lucky enough to have that kind of support. One educator and scientist wants to give all underprivileged and undercurious kids an opportunity to do great things by introducing them to a new kind of inexpensive educational toy. Producer Angela Johnston of KALW reports.
Despite the familiar song, no one is celebrating a birthday here today. I'm in a lab tucked away in the basement of a Stanford University engineering building. And the song coming from the tiny hand-cranked music box is actually, well, science. This music box has a plastic chip attached to it, a little silicon box filled with tiny channels of different fluids or chemicals that can be mixed together. It was designed by Manu Prakash, a bioengineering professor here at Stanford. When you crank the handle, the gears not only make sound, they are also triggering tiny pumps in the plastic chip to release minute amounts of chemical fluids, something you need to listen even closer to hear.
This is coding a specific chemistry that we care about. When I'm running this chip, whatever code was on this will get executed as chemistry on this chip.
As you turn the tape, more chemicals get released and mixed together. Prakash says these little boxes can be used for testing everything from disease markers to soil or water quality. Now, there isn't a water quality test or any test out there that actually plays Happy Birthday when you run it. A simple water quality test would actually sound something like this. Simply put, it's the sound of a ratio. One reagent or chemical mixed with half of another. Prakash's research assistant, Ben Alpers, explains.
For every one hole you punch in this line, you punch three holes in the other line, and every hole is one pump of that fluid.
The more complicated the ratio, the more complicated the sound. This way of mixing chemicals together, something called microfluidics, has been around for a while. But Prakash says it requires a lot of money and infrastructure, something that doctors and scientists in developing countries don't always have easy access to.
It's an expensive enterprise. What we wanted to do was bring out this idea of being able to do controlled reactions and handling chemicals completely in an automated way, but anywhere in the world. So we built something that doesn't require any power, doesn't require any electricity.
And it only costs $5. Building inexpensive universal scientific tools like this is one of the goals of Prakash's lab at Stanford. He calls it frugal science.
We've tested our instruments in Nigeria, Uganda. We did a small trial in Ghana. We are working in Cameroon recently.
But he has another aim that's just as important, fostering a non-goal-oriented curiosity among both kids and adults. He says that's something missing in science education today.
Because early on, kids get very focused on thinking about, hey, I want to solve this problem or that problem. So the tools that we make are completely open-ended. We really don't tell people what you want to do with it.
This curiosity-driven exploration is most evident in Prakash's other invention, the Foldscope. It's a paper microscope that's built by folding, like origami.
All the components are printed flat on a sheet of paper, and then you fold it together and you get a fully functional microscope.
One that you can slip into your back pocket. It's a tough little tool. Throw it off a three-story building or in the washing machine. Prakash has tried both. The Foldscope magnifies objects over 2,000 times. It can pick up subcellular structures like parasites, microbes, things 1/1,000,000th of a meter in size. Traditional microscopes of this strength cost upwards of $1,000. The Foldscope costs 50 cents.
Even though it looks like a simple object, it's a very powerful instrument.
At a recent event at Stanford's bioengineering department, Prakash's team distributed dozens of these Foldscopes to children. They could look at anything they wanted. Legs of an ant, strands of their hair. 13-year-old Jalen Devados and her 11-year-old brother Elias built one.
We were looking at little flatworms through a paper microscope called a Foldscope. I learned that you can see any kind of organism through just a 50-cent piece of paper and plastic.
I thought it was pretty cool because it only costs like 50 cents to make and it still works pretty well.
The kids are essentially beta testers, Prakash says. He has also created what he calls the 10,000 microscope project. Anyone who proposes a novel experiment with the Foldscope will get one. They received over 12,000 entries from over 130 countries, and it's still growing. They plan to ship 50,000 at the end of the month. There have been entries from award-winning chemists and biologists.
The goal is that, you know, curiosity is everywhere, and every question is a good question as long as you're passionate about asking it.
And Prakash says the DIY aspect of these tools can bring a deeper understanding and empowerment.
So we enforce this idea that people are going to build these instruments, modify, hack, and do whatever they want to do on top of it, which is also the spirit of all the instruments that we make. And there lies the idea of making sure that you don't consider scientific instruments as black boxes. It's a great instrument. It's a great scientific instrument, actually, but you don't have any idea of conceptually what went in it.
Prakash believes that the world will be a healthier and better place if everybody has the chance to make a scientific discovery, regardless of where you were born, your income level, or your age.
Right now, 2 billion kids on the planet, we're not giving them the choice. We're telling them, here is a book, pass all these hoops, and if you qualify to a certain extent, then you enter the club for doing science, which is a broken model of how scientific thinking should propagate.
And because of that, Prakash hopes someday every scientist and every kid can carry a fold scope or a music box chemistry set in their back pocket.
And that piece came to us thanks to Angela Johnston. Thank you so much for listening today. There is plenty more to hear and to explore at wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.